we're roaring right along here in chapter 5, cause of all causes. In the beginning of the chapter, there's two verses where Narada addresses Brahma. Shukadeva Goswami is referring to this conversation because it perfectly answers the question Maharaj Pariksit asked: how does the Lord, through his creative potencies, manifest this universe, the whole cosmic manifestation? So that's the same question Narada asked Brahma. And he asked some other things along with that question. It's important that in the first verse, Narada offers his obeisances to the personality of Godhead. And to Lord Brahma, who understands the subject of the soul and the super soul perfectly well. Looking for a particular reference. Back in the fourth chapter, text number 23, Shukadeva Goswami is offering prayers to the Supreme Lord to empower his speech, and he refers to that feature of the Supreme Lord he who manifests the 16 divisions of material modes, which are his generator, so the generator of the living entity. So these 16, these features that come from the Supreme Lord then become the ingredients that Brahma uses to create the bodies of all conditioned beings in creation. So Shukadeva Goswami is giving us like a little snapshot of what's to come. In this discussion between Narada and Brahma, Narada wants to know, we heard yesterday afternoon, how do you do it? Where does the energy come from? Where does the intelligence come from? Where does the plan come from? What's in the background? And are you the energetic source of everything? Or when I see you engaged in austerities and meditation, why do you have to undergo austerities? And upon whom are you meditating? Are you the Supreme, or is there someone above you, and what's going on? So Brahma systematically is answering these questions. We ended up with his answering just a few questions. One of them is he appreciates the nature of the questions Narada has asked, and he's a little bit amused that the bewildering potency of the Supreme Lord is such that even Narada is not clear. Prabhupada explains, it's like Arjuna being not clear. Krishna also is inducing Narada to be not clear so that he can ask the question so that we can be clear. And he gets it the first time, whereas we may have to read it many times before we become clear that he's Narada and we're ourselves. So one of the questions is, please describe the nature of this created region. And one of the answers given by Brahma is the nature of this created region is that it bewilders living entities. It's designed to bewilder living entities. Yaya samohito jiva atmanam trigunatmakam. They become really bewildered. And the symptom of that bewilderment is false ego and false sense of possessiveness. False ego is, it is I. And possessiveness is, it is mine. And then the modes of nature spin, and the varieties of it is I and it is mine are awesome. But the nexus or the hub is it is I, it is mine. That's the driving force behind the deluding influence. Now, of Maya, and if the deluding influence, if the misconception is removed and in place a spiritual conception is put, then the modes of nature cannot act. They cannot spin the mind of the conditioned soul, or they cannot spin the mind of the liberated soul. So he's letting us know that just as Krishna let Arjuna know, that's where you have to go deeply, the eye and mind conception, just as he does in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, the eye conception and then the mind conception. What is the soul? What is the covering of the soul? That's the first part of chapter 2. And the second part of chapter 2 is what is mind? The sense of being focused upon the personality of Godhead, and on the basis of that focus upon the personality of Godhead with intelligence, letting go of the fruits of work and dedicating the fruits of the work to the Supreme, which is just the beginning, because beyond that is not just letting go of the fruits of work but dedicating everything to the Supreme. So, in today's verses, we're going to cover text 14, 15, and 16. Chapter 5. So after describing the deluding influence, the eye and mind program of the material world, where one even thinks that someone other than the Supreme Lord is the Supreme Lord, another nice feature of delusion, where whether it's Brahma or oneself or somebody else, the deluding feature is part of the characteristic of this created realm. Now he's going to address the, what is the background of this creation? So this ties into that verse 23 of chapter 4, where in verse 23 of chapter 4, Shukadeva Goswami prays to the Supreme Lord to empower his speech to represent the understanding he received from Vyasa correctly, and to present realized knowledge and to illumine the hearts of his audience. It's that Supreme Lord who generates these 16 modes of manifestation. So now that's referred to here by Brahma, text 14. The five elementary ingredients of creation, the interaction thereof, set up by eternal time. Bhagavad Gita. The intuition or nature of the individual living beings. These are all differentiated parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva. And in truth, there is no other value in them. So this is packed. There's, if you're familiar, just a little sharing while we're waiting for the Bhagavad Gita. When you're familiar with key phrases from Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, when you hear one of those key phrases, a light goes off over there, and a light goes off over there, and a light, because the phrase indicates an important way by which Krishna conveys a message. So I'll just show you what I mean by that, two or three examples of that. The five, so the Sanskrit is dravyam, karma cha kalascha, svabhavo jiva evacha, vasudevat paro brahman, nachanyo arkosti tatpataha. So there's the five gross ingredients. That's dravya. Dravya. Dravya means things, objects, stuff. And then there's the activity that goes along with the living entity mixing with stuff, mixing with, so the living entity is injected by the glance of Mahavishnu into Pradhan, along with the time energy. And then stuff happens, activity happens, because of time, because of karma, because of the living entity. So those of you that like Bhagavad Gita, and you know that the introduction to Bhagavad Gita says there are five topics: time, living entity, material nature, the Supreme Ishvara. So that generates karma. You have to have material nature, you have to have time, you have to have a living entity, the Supreme Lord. Then you get activity. So what is activity? Activity is a mixture of the living entity with stuff and time under the direction of the Supreme Lord. So now, Bhagavad Gita chapter 13, text 6 and 7. Where Krishna is describing the distinction between the field of activities and the knower of the field of activities, kshetra and kshetra-gya. What falls in the category of field of activities? It's stuff and stuff mixing with stuff. It's the material ingredients and the material ingredients along with the subtle material ingredients mixing together. You don't get the mixing without time, and you'll get the mixing without the living entity. But the mixing falls in the category of kshetra. It's not kshetra-gya. It's not conscious. Like in the Bhakti Riksha group, the question was, why is material nature called inferior? Because you can do good things with stuff. Why is it inferior? It's inferior in the sense that it's not conscious. So here's text 6 and 7 from chapter 13. The operative word is interaction. and the Sanskrit word is vikarangs cha. So there's stuff, and then the stuff interacts. This, you get varieties of stuff. The five gross elements, false ego, intelligence, the unmanifest, the ten senses in the mind, five sense objects. So that's the five gross elements plus the three subtle elements, and in the Sankhya system it becomes 24 instead of 8. So here's a question. In Bhagavad Gita we find there's 8 separated energy. Bina Prakritir Ashtada. Correct? Chapter 7, text 4. And in the Sankhya system found in Srimad Bhagavatam, there's 24 elements. So, which system is right or wrong, or is one system better than the other system? And the answer is, they're both valid systems. They're valid systems because they come from the Supreme Lord. One system looks like this, the other system looks like that, but it's the same system. I mean, it's the same knowledge, just presented differently. It's like, you know, you can get a Rand McNally roadmap to get you from Chicago to Los Angeles, or you can look on a globe and, you know, get from Chicago to Los Angeles, or you can, both are maps, and a map that's this way that's got a curve in it, a map that's flat, it doesn't have a curve in it, but it does the purpose. It's just a perspective on it, if that helps, using that example. They're both valid systems. So here in the 13th chapter, although Krishna, the 7th chapter, uses that system of 8, here we're using the system of 24. And then he says, then those 24 mix. And they mix by the influence of the living entity and the karma he's carrying, and also time energy. And then in the mix, you get desire and hate, happiness and distress, life symptoms and convictions. So all these happen due to the field of activities and their interactions. So where does desire and hate arise from? And happiness and distress, it's within the mind. But it's the mind interacting with objects according to the karma and time, energy, and the modes of nature living entities accustomed to associate with. And then you get this other stuff. And it's all in the category of stuff. For the sake of self-realization, it's not who we are. Desire and hate and attraction and repulsion and happiness and distress, it's over there somewhere. It's apart from who we really are. And in illusion, because that's what the previous verse is describing, in illusion, one identifies with the illusion. That's me. And it's mine. I own that emotion. Or the emotion is me. I'm feeling lusty, or I'm feeling anger, or I'm feeling joy, or I'm feeling sadness, or I'm feeling... And that's me. That's reality. In the deluding feature of the material world, it's reality. And in the absolute feature, it's just the field of activities and its interactions. It's a movie. And it's not who we are. But it's part of a feature. The movie is part of the feature of the material world. And it's subtle, so you don't catch it unless, you know, this thing that's happening right here, transcendental knowledge, is descending and being imparted by Brahma to Narada, and Narada to Vyas, and Vyas to Shukadeva, and the cyclic succession to us. One remains deluded. Okay, so the five elementary ingredients of creation, dravyam, the interaction thereof set up by eternal time, karmacha, kalascha, the intuition or nature of the living beings. Footnote, this means the conditioned nature. The Sanskrit word is swabhava. Now, there's a constitutional swabhava and there's a conditional swabhava, and even Krishna has a swabhava and is certainly not conditioned. But the conventional sense of how swabhava is used is the conditioned behavior, the nature, the psychophysical nature, conditioned nature of a living being. So that's swabhava. Brahma karma swabhava jam, chatra karma swabhava jam, vaishya karma krishi goraksha vanajam, vaishya karma swabhava jam, swabhava. It's one's nature. It's not just behaviors, but behaviors are born of one's nature. So in Krishna consciousness, we want to minimally cultivate goodness so that we can more readily access our true nature, our constitutional nature as a servant of Krishna, and ultimately the particular relationship with Krishna that we have that is our constitutional rasa. Nature, our eternal spiritual nature. But now Brahma is addressing over on this side, the conditioned side, the material side, the five ingredients, the interaction thereof under the influence of time, the swabhava of the conditioned souls. He calls it their intuition, kind of like, you know, intuitively Brahma knew, I got to create a universe. And we have our nature also, born of our nature. We just, there's some instinctive, use this word, instinctive, this conditioned, born of karma and guna association. We're disposed to a certain type of activity. Like this thing, you know, when the ceremony is performed, the grain ceremony is performed for a child and put them before the book and the coin, and, you know, they'll go for one or go for the other. And there's a name that's indicating, it's supposed to at least indicate, they have a disposition or a nature. What's the nature of this child? Money or knowledge? You know, put guns and explosives in front of children. But I suppose that might be something that can't happen in the future. Activity is born of what our nature is. And we can mold our nature towards the mode of goodness side and awaken the spiritual side. That's where spiritual practice comes. But on the conditioned side, with that, minus that spiritual practice and cultivation, there's a certain nature that we all have. And the statement that Brahma is making is that these are all differentiated parts and parcels. We've heard that phrase so many times. Differentiated parts and parcels. Generally that phrase is combined with the living entities. They're the differentiated parts and parcels. But here it's being used, Prabhupada is using this phrase, as the material ingredients as well as the individual souls. There's differentiation, there's breakdowns of matter. And those are differentiations of matter. While they're differentiated, it should be understood they're intimately connected with the personality of Godhead. although they're inferior energy, they're intimately connected. And this, so within this is the Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva philosophy, very neatly tucked in there. And in truth, there is no other value in them. In truth, there is no other value in them. Now, for those of you that, when you become a little more familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam, a bell will ring when you hear that. The Sanskrit is Nachanyo Artos Ti Katvataha. So, this is one of the Chatur Sloki verses. The bell that's ringing for me is 2934. Chatur Sloki verse. Brahma, his learning from directly from the Supreme Lord, now he's sharing it with Narada. This is the Siddhic succession. In the nutshell verses of Bhagavatam, there's this statement by Lord Vishnu to Brahma describing what his illusory energy is. His illusory energy is seeing that there's artha, something of intrinsic value, separate from the Supreme Lord. Know that to be my illusory energy. It's one of the essential, four essential verses of the Bhagavatam, and it's tucked very neatly into this verse, where Brahma is saying there is no other artha, value, in these dravya and dravya karma and kala and vikara, the interactions and the stuff and the variety of the stuff interacts with stuff under the influence of time. There's no value to it at all outside of their relationship to the Supreme Lord. If one sees there is value, that's Maya. So we have this ISKCON phrase, you're in Maya, Prabhu. Or Giriraj Maharaj tells the story that one time in Juhu, Prabhupada was giving lectures, and one morning he was not feeling well, and so Giriraj Maharaj was seated at his feet, and Prabhupada asked him to speak instead, and he had practically had a heart attack in Prabhupada's presence. I'm supposed to speak, and so he was ordered by Prabhupada again to do so, and so he began speaking, and in the course of the lecture he was explaining something and said, and then I fell into Maya, and Prabhupada interrupted and said, and then you fell into Maya, and then you fell into Maya, you are always in Maya. Smiled. So sometimes we experience relief from Maya, and otherwise it's this experience of seeing things to be of value apart from Krishna, which gives a clue. Krishna consciousness is seeing the value of things is their relationship with Krishna. And devotional service is how to use things favorably in service to Krishna. So we may not know how to use things favorably in service to Krishna, so then you just see a flashing yellow light that says, beware. You wait a while till you can understand how to use that thing in Krishna's service. Don't go experimenting, because you might get burned. But once you do understand, then you proceed cautiously and try to keep the consciousness behind the activity that this is for the pleasure of Krishna. And then Krishna will instruct how to use this thing properly in his service. You know, you have some service. You have, you know, you're teaching children in Sunday school, or you're raising a family, or you're trying to establish a community, or you're trying to spread Krishna consciousness, or you're looking after the finances of the temple, or whatever it is. You're doing some service. How do I do this in a way that is pleasing to Krishna? There's the how-to part, and then there's the consciousness behind the how-to part. Krishna will supply the how-to part very easily, more easily than the consciousness part. That's the primary work that we have. I think you detect this is a consistent instruction that I'm regularly giving. This is our brahminical work, or it's our Vaishnava work, the consciousness behind the activity. Because when the consciousness is right, then you'll see the stuff not having value apart from Krishna, which means it's up for grabs. Doesn't belong to Krishna, doesn't seem to belong to anybody else. Let me get my hands on it, put it in my pocket and go walking down the street and think about how I can use it for myself. Like the discussion yesterday about from the brahmachari that's with Jayadvita Maharaj, when someone offers him appreciation for some service, it bewilders, because what do you do with that appreciation? You can say Krishna's mercy, but it's just, you know, it's mechanical. Krishna's mercy, Prabhu. So, unless it's what's in your heart. Anyway, something appropriate and good fortune comes your way. How do you handle that in Krishna's service? Or some difficulty comes your way. How do you handle that in Krishna's service? Etc. It requires strong Krishna consciousness. And we're not so strong yet, so we have to practice from the position of Krishna consciousness, whatever Krishna consciousness we have. And Krishna will decorate our sincere efforts with proper choices, and then the outcomes will flow from those proper choices, and that's Krishna's mercy. It's Krishna's mercy even though we're thinking to make proper choices. Or that we're thinking we have to be in the right consciousness. So, the instruction in the Bhagavatam that Brahma is giving to Narada is there is no value to this whole display other than the purpose that it fulfills for the Supreme Lord who creates it. He's providing the living entities with an opportunity to do two things. Try to enjoy independence from him and learn the lesson that they shouldn't do that. They should serve him. Then, in the purport, Prabhupada goes back to a statement that was made earlier by Brahma, the earlier statement being the Svarochisa statement, that the seed of all existences in this world comes from the Supreme, but it comes from the Supreme through the transformation of the Brahma Jyoti. Then the seeds are provided, and the gardener Brahma cultivates the seed and he makes varieties within the universe. But the seed, the soil, the water, the intelligence, the plan, it's all supplied by the Supreme Lord in his primary creation. And then Brahma does the secondary creation as a gardener. So here's how Prabhupada addresses this in the purport. The living entity is known as the marginal potency of the Lord. In all circumstances, neither the material ingredients nor the spiritual parts and parcels are independent of the personality of Godhead Vasudev. For all things, whether products of the external, internal, or marginal potency of the Supreme Lord, are simply displays of the same effulgence of the Lord. Just as heat, light, and smoke are displays of fire. So, in the Bhakti Bhikshu group on Friday night, from the introduction to Bhagavad Gita, there's reference to the Vishnu Puran verse. It's a nice verse. If you like to memorize verses, it's a nice one to know. In the verse, the three categories of energy, this internal, external, and marginal, from Vishnu Purana. That's the scriptural reference. And the scriptural reference begins, Vishnu Shakti Para Prokta. That's the first one. The energies of Lord Vishnu. So this is standard Vaishnava subject matter. Vishnu Puran is the principal scripture for the Sri Vaishnavas. Vishnu Puran and Padma Puran, the Sattvic Purans, as Srimad Bhagavatam is our principal scriptural reference. So, Vishnu Shakti Para Prokta, that's the spiritual energy. Kshetragya, Kshetra Gyakya Tatapara. So this is the second one. Kshetra Gya, same language as Bhagavad Gita. Kshetra and Kshetra Gya, distinguishing matter from the knower of matter. The conscious living entity is Kshetra Gyakya Tatapara. It's also in the para position, but it's in distinct from the para prakriti, it's the marginal energy. And then, very similar to the language of this Bhagavatam verse, avidya karma sangyaya. Avidya karma, that's the external energy. And the activities of the external energy, same as this verse that I referred to, chapter 13, text 6 and 7. Avidya karma. It's the elements and their interactions. It makes karma, it makes attraction, repulsion, happiness, distress, pleasure, displeasure, all that stuff. Emotions. It's just material energy. Material emotions is nothing but material energy. Mind interacting with the modes of nature and time and material elements. So, the statement that Prabhupada is repeating in this purport, resonating with the previous verse, the text 11 verse of this chapter, where Brahma says, I create after the Lord's creation by his personal effulgence known as the Brahma Jyoti. Just as when the sun manifests its fire, the moon, the firmament, the influential planets, and the twinkling stars also manifest their brightness. The brightness of the stars, the brightness of the moon, the brightness of the heavenly planets, the brightness of the firmament, like, you know, the firmament, when there's light in the sky, there's the sun and then there's the light in the sky. The firmament. That light in the sky is the result of the sun. And the moon is the result of the light of the sun. The stars are the light of the sun. One is a product of the other. So they can do their thing after the sun does its thing. And similarly, Brahma says, I can do my thing after the Lord does his thing. He makes everything manifest. And then I take everything that's manifest and I do something with it. And that's true, as it's true for the Creator Brahma, it's also true for us. That's the application point. We should, if we understand, as Brahma understands, all stuff comes from the Supreme Lord. I just do stuff with that stuff. Just interactions. the living entity, time, karma, the gross elements, like, you know, kids in a sandbox. That's all. And you may like, you know, the sandcastle that I made. Wait a while, time will knock it over. But if you want to appreciate the sandcastle, appreciate where the intelligence to make the sandcastle come, where the ingredients to make the sandcastle come, where the time energy to make the ability for events to happen come from, where the living entities come from, and there's no meaning to any of this other than its connection with the Supreme Lord. That's Krishna consciousness. Although you may build sandcastles, or you may go to the office, or you may, whatever you may do, there's no meaning to any of it other than its relation to the Supreme Lord. And those things are transformations of the Brahma-jyoti. He's emphasizing it again. It's not like a prominent theme in all of Vaishnava teachings, but it's here in the second canto, and so Prabhupada's repeating it again, so I am too. And he says that just as, he makes a metaphor, just as heat, light, and smoke exist because of the fire, you find heat, you find light, you find smoke, any one of those three or combination, you know there's a fire. Like, you know, it starts to get hot on the wall. It may not be flames coming out of the wall yet, but you know you got electrical fire happening. You better do something, because let it go and some flames are going to come out of the wall. There's heat, there's light, there's smoke. Little smoke starts coming. Whoa. So there's symptoms because of the existence of fire. Brahma is saying this stuff and their interactions and karma should tell you, aha, the Supreme Lord. Or an intermediate step is the Brahma-jyoti, the Supreme Lord. Because the Brahma-jyoti, he outlined from the verses yesterday, Pratishtha, the existential presence of Brahman is because of Bhagavan. Brahmanohi Pratishtha. And that Brahman is the pratishta of the seeds that Brahma receives, and then existences come into being. And then we come in after Brahma does bringing existence into being. We play in a sandbox, thinking, this is great, without any recognition of the sequences of prior existence. So it was like children. But when children grow up and go to school, they may understand this, the basis and support of all things is Vishnu. So there's Vishnu Shakti. I mean, some philosophers, they want to say this reference of the Vishnu Shakti verse, Vishnu Shakti para prokta kshetra gyakya tatha para avidya karma sangyaya tritiya shaktir ishyate. It's in a discussion that Lord Chaitanya has with Prakashananda Saraswati, who is this Maha Sannyasi with thousands of Sannyasi followers, tooting his horn about Lord Chaitanya, the sentimentalist. He doesn't study Vedanta Sutra. Don't take him seriously. So Lord Chaitanya challenges him and says, do you mean to say that the Supreme Lord has no potencies when the scriptures are replete with understanding the Supreme Lord has innumerable potencies? Come again? And he quotes this verse. And I'd like to also, there's two verses that follow it from Vishnu Puran and following in the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya. We can also quote them. Hopefully. Okay. Yeah. O King, the one that follows it is, O King, this is Parashramuni instructing some king. The Kshetragya Shakti is the living entity. Now he describes his marginal nature. Although he has the facility to live in either the material or spiritual world, he suffers the threefold miseries of material existence because he is influenced by the avidya, or Nesha's potency, which covers his constitutional position. Please note that this is the same thing that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 13.6.7. There, the living entity experiencing distress and so-called happiness, of course it's so-called distress also, is due to the avidya potency, which connects with what Brahma is saying to Narada. This, the feature of the material world, it's really fantastic. It bewilders all living entities into thinking I am mine, to thinking things like Lord Brahma is the supreme, or even that they are supreme. They may not have an explicit philosophy, but they're thinking like that. I'm supreme. I am the enjoyer. Look out, here I come. Because I'm going to make sure that I enjoy. I'm going to rearrange things until it's my enjoyment. Of course, they bump into a few other people that are thinking the same way, and they have a little conflict. You know, the war of the gods. The third verse of Vishnu Purana that Lord Chaitanya quotes, the living entity, covered by the influence of nescience, exists in different forms in the material condition. So, variety in this material world, the variety of stuff, the configuration of material existence, has to do with the svabhava, the conditioned nature of the living entity. You know, the consciousness that's within the living entity constitutionally is, I'm Krishna's eternal servant. When one abandons I am the eternal servant of Krishna consciousness, then one goes across this bridge of false ego into the land of lava land and thinks, I'm the enjoyer. And how should I enjoy? And the conditioned tendency gives so much variety to that according to the modes of nature, guna, and karma. And living entities overly busy trying to be the enjoyer in illusion, abandoning his real happiness and finding this la-la land of maya where there's distress at every step, and he's calling it happiness because it's less distressful than the previous one, only that less distressful one leads to more distress, much to his chagrin. So the living entity becomes deluded by abandoning the sense of his constitutional consciousness and becomes conditioned by this avidya shakti. O King, he is thus proportionally freed from the influence of material energy to a greater or lesser degree. That is, by the linking process of devotion. And it's in degrees, up to the full degree of being reinstated in our constitutional position. That's certainly not only possible, it's wanted by the Supreme Lord. And if he wants it, then it becomes possible for us. So these three, light, heat, and smoke, this is the metaphor, none of them are separate from fire. Altogether they make up what fire is, or at least the symptoms of fire. And similarly, in the metaphor, all phenomenal manifestations, there's not an exception, all phenomenal manifestations, and not only good kind and the intermediate kind, even the bad kind, they're all manifestations of the Supreme Lord, as well as the effulgence of the body of Vasudeva. They're all his impersonal features, because the question was, what's the background of all this? And the background is Vishnu. And then there's Vishnu Shakti in different categories. And then there's the Jyoti of Vishnu. And that's an impersonal manifestation of him. From that Brahma Jyoti come the seeds, and come the seeds, come the Brahma's work, and he grows the seeds, and we get manifestation of these avidya karma and kshatragya karma prakriti. And then there's the spiritual energy. Spiritual energy is far more attractive, but we somehow just stubbornly hold on to the avidya karma shakti. But whatever it is, spiritual and material and marginal, it's manifestation of the Lord's energies. Whereas he eternally exists in his transcendental form called Satchitananda Vigraha, distinct from all conceptions of material ingredients mentioned above. So there's the neat little package of what's the background to all of this. Now, the next two verses focus on the background. And Brahma likes to glorify Krishna, and Krishna likes the enthusiasm of Brahma to glorify him. And he, in the text 15 and 16 of chapter 5 are almost identical with first canto chapter 2, text 28 and 29. First we'll do 28-29 from Canto 1, Chapter 2. Just do a little refresh. Canto 1, Chapter 2, what's that about? It's about the answers, citing the answers that Sutta is supplying to the sages, to their six questions, at least four of them. What is the essence of all Vedic knowledge? And what is the process to achieve that essence, the process of devotional service? And, of course, then at the end of describing the process of devotional service, there is the object of devotion, the modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, this the smoke is better than raw wood is better than earth, fire is better than smoke, indicating the modes of nature, mode of goodness is best. There's modes of worship according to the modes of nature. Those in ignorance worship this way, passion worship this way. Those in goodness worship Vishnu. And then these verses. Vasudeva para veda, Vasudeva para makha, Vasudeva para yoga, Vasudeva para kriyaha, and in case you didn't get it, Vasudeva param jnanam, Vasudeva param tapaha, Vasudeva paro dharmo, Vasudeva para gatihi. Three times is for absolute emphasis, eight times is for dummies. He is the object of worship for the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, Brahma does the same thing with Narada. Narayana para veda deva narayanagat gajaha narayana para loka narayana para makaha narayana paro yoga narayana param tapaha narayana param jnanam narayana para gatihi. You're thinking I'm the personality of Godhead? Ha! Narayana Paraveda. So the Supreme Lord Narayan is my worshipable Lord and my beloved Son. He is the Supreme and I'm engaged in His service. And He gives me my service, He gives me the intelligence, He gives the, because you were asking where the energies come from and where does the intelligence come from? There's where it comes from. And His Sat-Chit Ananda Vigraha, not just this impersonal Brahman, because the impersonal Brahman are, it is but the rays of His body, and the rays of His body are existentially resting upon Him, or He is the pratishtha of those rays. He is the background. And moreover, the manifestations which come from Him have no other meaning, no other artha or value other than the relationship with Him. That's Krishna consciousness. So, repetition, as Prabhupada explains, is necessary for clear understanding. So consider that the two junctures, once again, the second canto is introducing the topics of, the first canto is introducing the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam, particularly the first three chapters, and in describing the process of realization and the modes of worship, the mode of worship that the Bhagavatam is teaching is the personality of Godhead should be worshipped. Like in Bhagavad Gita, Mamekam Shananam. Exclusively, don't worship others, exclusively worship the personality of Godhead. Eka Shananam. And here, Vasudeva, or here, Narayana. He is the object of worship. In Canto 1, He is the source of everything. Therefore, He's the worshipable in Canto 2. Cause of all causes. Attention goes to the personality of Godhead when we think of creation. Okay? The translation reads, the Vedic literatures are made by and are meant for the Supreme Lord. So in the purport, Prabhupada very neatly one sentence says, according to Vedanta Shastra Sutras, there's this phrase, Shastra Yonitvat. So it doesn't say Krishna is the source of, because the Vedanta Sutra is in sutras. So Yonitvat. Having the quality of being the source of scripture. The absolute truth, Krishna, has this vat, has this, possesses the quality of being the source of all scriptures. Just unpacking the thing. Shastra yonit vat. So Vedanta Sutra says, Krishna is the source of all knowledge of all the Vedas. Krishna says the same thing in 15:15 Bhagavad Gita. Vedaischa Sayurvair Aham Eva Vedyo Vedanta Krid. I'm the compiler of the Vedas. I am the knower of the Vedas. So, and here, same thing. Narayana Para Veda. Same as first canto. Krishna is the object of and the compiler of and the knower of the Vedas. There's three confirmations of the same point. Veda means knowledge that leads to the Lord. Then Prabhupada goes in the other direction. That is, if there's literature that doesn't lead us to knowledge of the Supreme Lord, we reject it. He says it three times. We reject it, we reject it, we reject it. Any literature not meant for reviving God consciousness is rejected at once by the Narayana Para devotees. Then he says it again. Such deluding books of knowledge, not having Narayana as their aim, are not at all knowledge, but are the playgrounds for crows who are interested in the rejected refuse of the world. And again, any book of knowledge, science or art, must lead to the knowledge of Narayana, otherwise it must be rejected. Okay. Yes, sir. Because the Narayana Para, and now this phrase, Narayana Parayana or Vasudev Parayana, is another important phrase in the Bhagavatam. A light starts to flash. Narayana Paraksage Nakutashana Bibhyati Svarga Apavarga Naraka. So one who has this Narayana Para, that's the devotee that has as their life and soul Narayana. And they understand Narayana in this way, as Brahma is explaining to Narada. He is everything. And that which doesn't lead to the understanding of Krishna is everything, stay away from it. Reject it like garbage. The pilgrimage of crows. We don't have this phenomena in America, but we have the phenomena in India. A garbage heap. Such unsanitary ways, and it's just shocking. Anyway, people go just dump their garbage on the street somewhere, and then the crows come and, you know, have their crow festival every day. So the garbage truck comes, and then they, you know, go find another pile of garbage somewhere. And that which is rejected becomes the pilgrimage for crows. But the swans don't go to the garbage heap. The swans are in the lakes where there's nice lotus flowers and very pleasing. So swan-like persons should go to that literature which is going to bring one to God consciousness and reject the other rubbish literature. Then he's the object of service. That connects with the second canto idea that Vishnu is the object of worship of those in the mode of goodness. And Prabhupada now here describes in the ways of worship the Supreme Lord Narayana or Vasudeva, Krishna or Vishnu. It's a Vaishnava perspective that he should be worshipped while the demigods are recommended secondarily for worship in relation to Narayana, because the demigods are assisting hands in the management of the universal affairs, just like Lord Chaitanya when he traveled in South India. Sometimes he would go to various temples besides Vishnu temples, but he saw those personalities that were being respected in relation to Vishnu. Prabhupada writes, as the officers of a kingdom are respected due to their relation to the king, the demigods are worshipped due to their relation with the Lord. Or we observe Shivaratri in that way, that Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu. Respect Lord Shiva in that way. Once, when I was visiting in, well, you know, it wasn't once, it became an annual thing. When visiting in Warangal, there's a congregation member of our ISKCON Warangal temple that volunteered to do some service, community service, by establishing something like a prasadam hall for one of those mountains where inside, up the mountain, there's in the cave, there's a deity of Lord Sringadeva on one side and a deity of Lord Shiva on the other side, another cave. And pilgrims go up the big steps to get to the temple. So we were invited annually to make a whole presentation on Shivaratri, and it was really interesting. Thousands and tens of thousands of people were gathered, and we just chanted Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, and Shivaratri, and did it year after year, and the crowd really got into it year after year, and clapping and dancing, and then with the translation in Telugu, that what Lord Shiva's position is as worshipable because of his intimate service to Krishna. And they had never heard that before. And they didn't. The priests were liking it too. Anyway, one can honor Lord Shiva in that way. We don't worship Lord Shiva separately, but anyway, here's, without the Lord's relation, worship of the demigods is unauthorized, of any purvakam. Language of Bhagavad Gita. Those who worship the demigods are doing so with avidhi purvakam, without proper understanding. So, worship is meant for Narayan. And Narayana Paro Nyogo, all different types of meditation or mysticism, are meant for realizing Narayana. Prabhupada comments in the purport that the worship or the Sankhya process of meditation commonly is impersonal. Although the Sankhya taught by Lord Kapila to Devahuti is personal. Meditation on the form of the Lord and engage in his service and trance of meditation. That's the process that Kapila gave. But there's this other atheistic Kapila who taught Sankhya that taught impersonal meditation. And the other Ashtanga yoga system predominantly also is meditation on impersonal. But the Bhagavatam is teaching us it's ultimately meant for worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that's the Bhagavatam's teaching. So the conclusion here, impersonal Brahman is situated on the person of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and as such, Brahman is the glorification of the Personality of Godhead. This is confirmed in both Bhagavad Gita and the Matsya Purana. So impersonal meditation is unfortunately incomplete. Such persons, if only they could understand this relationship of the impersonal Brahman to the Supreme Lord. This is a decoration of the Supreme Lord or his effulgence. And Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasya Pihitam Mukam. Please remove your dazzling effulgence so I can see your form. It's right there. The Upanishads are teaching, but impersonal inclination is so strong they cannot see it, even if it's right there. Okay, so late 8:30. Any comments or questions?
I just want to understand better the equation that is said. Five elements plus interaction to kala and karma plus the condition of living entity, the sacred nature, leads to emotions.
Well, The more specifically, yes, but more specifically, the reference in chapter 13 involves the subtle elements also, mind, intelligence, false ego. Because emotions take place in the mind, and that's, but there's stimuli from outside the mind, the knowledge acquiring senses.
And the thing that condition of the living entity, you said that I thought condition of the living entity arises because of the mind interaction with the nature. Plus, but here the condition is, you said, once we fall into, once we want to enjoy separate from Krishna, then there are different types of conditions that arises.
Well, but those two models that you just presented don't, they're not mutually exclusive models. The lens through which the soul in contact with matter evaluates things is the mind. You know, that it takes, the mind takes help from the intelligence when it comes to, you know, I want to rearrange the configuration of matter out there. Can you set it up for me? I want happiness instead of distress. But that just implicates the living entity further. But so the two models, the two statements, are not contradictory statements.
I mean, on that, I understand that once we want to enjoy separate from Krishna,
that's the starting point.
And you said the condition of living entity. Will there be different condition of living entity?
Sure.
Based on how they want to enjoy separate from Krishna.
Yeah.
And that is a separate, that
there's a subdivision of the main category.
And because I previously thought that interaction with mind with elements will bring about the condition rather than,
say it again slower, you thought that what?
The interaction of the material mind with the elements and will bring about the condition of the nature rather than condition is like standalone feature.
That model that you just described doesn't contradict the previous model. There's the seat of consciousness, that's the soul. And then there's all these faculties or facilities, one of which is the mind. So you describe in terms of the soul doesn't mean, okay, that's the model that explains things, so we have to reject this thing that says what the mind does. Just a different map to get to the same place, a different way of explaining, or a subset of explaining the same thing. They don't contradict. The mind does act with different material elements according to the conditioning of the mind. One finds this combination is distress and that combination is happiness, whereas another mind says it's happiness and it's distress. It's just the opposite. Same configuration of matter. For one man's food is another man's poison. It's just conditioning. The starting point of the conditioning is, I want to enjoy apart from Krishna. Then I start to see things having value apart from Krishna. It's Maya. They have no value or meaning apart from Krishna. That's Krishna consciousness. But I don't, you know, the conditioned soul says, forget that. I don't want that. How's that happiness? That's suffocation. There goes all my enjoyment. I don't want that. So they get illusion. They still exist, but it's the fundamental enjoying apart from the Supreme Lord. And then, What does the mind do? You know, you've said it twice, you can say it again. That's what the mind does. And that is another way of describing how conditioning takes place. Once that preliminary choice is made. It's further downstream. something else? Yes. Yes.
Maharaj, yes. The 15th verse of the chapter, did it say that the Vedas are from Krishna and are for Krishna? Did I hear that wrong?
Text 15. The Vedic literatures are made by Krishna and are meant for the Supreme Lord. The Vedic literatures are made by and are meant for.
What does it mean, meant for?
They're meant for realizing Him, meant for serving Him, meant for connecting one to Him. They're meant for Him. By the Vedas I am to be known.
Oftentimes I hear from my parents particularly and friends that there are certain things in this world and you're supposed to lose them, and the Bhagavatam understanding is the proper usage of it. Everything is in relation to Krishna. So what is the lacking thing in their conception? Is it just...
It's very fundamental. It's mine is Krishna. And your position is very fundamental. Those things have their place in relation to Krishna.
Because it extends even to relationships.
Sure, everything. Sure. Duties. And it's, so they're thinking, how have you become corrupted? And you're thinking, how can I get them to understand that there's not a problem with duties? The problem is with seeing the duties apart from Krishna. But they don't want to see in relation to Krishna, because the relation to Krishna puts... There's a number of reasons they don't want to see that. What, you know, fundamentally is, you know, I want to enjoy. But part of it is, a big part of it is, my experience is, they'll have to say to themselves, gee, I've just lived X number of years without a right conception. Or the defense way of saying the same thing is, do you mean to tell me that my son knows more than me? What kind of mentality have you developed? Or something like that. So Krishna's indication is best not to disturb the minds of such people, but encourage them in ways of devotion. And that part's easy, which when they have expectations that aren't fulfilled. When they say jump, you don't jump. Unless it's in relation to Krishna. And so now you as a practitioner have to make some sense of evaluation, which is, I have this duty and I have duty to Krishna. So if you're not clear in your Krishna consciousness, you'll be bewildered by what seems to be a conflict of duties when it's not a conflict of duty. The conflict is they have an expectation that's not being fulfilled. So they're frustrated. That's the problem. But there's no, from your position, there's no conflict of duty. Pleasing Krishna is your principal duty. Now, how to do that, there may be different ways of looking at how to do that, but that's clear. they'll want to argue, you please your parents, that's pleasing to Krishna. And your parents want you to do this, whether Krishna likes it or not. Wait a minute. Let's do that one again. Let's see how does that go. So they'll remain, as long as they hold an expectation that doesn't match what Krishna wants, then, you know, there'll be frustration. So don't rub the frustration in. You just try to be as best you can, you know, especially in areas where for you there is no compromise, you'd be the best a son imaginable, then do that, you know, from their perspective. Be very polite, be very dutiful, be very, you know, because in areas that there is no conflict with pleasing Krishna, do so. And when they are in their conflict, they just have to, you know, get over it. You're going to spend some time every morning and chant japa, and that's, you know, I have to live with that. There are certain foods that you're just not going to eat, and they're going to have to live with that. Still the struggle, right?
Yeah.
Just be sure that your priorities are straight and that you're then you're as Jagatananda put very nicely yesterday, you're feeling very clear and secure in your relationship with Guru and Krishna. Then you're safe and protected. Yeah.
Okay. I'll phrase the statements which will lead to a question. You mentioned that the activity is born out of one's nature, so bhava, in the conditioned state or in the unconditioned state.
Devotional service comes out of the nature that we're constitutionally Krishna's servants. That's where varieties of service spring out of.
And so that is awakened by Swadhana Bhakti, you said. So, which is of course performed under the guidance of a spiritual master. So it seems that one has to be able to be in touch with one's nature. Of course, that has to be again, checked.
Both conditioned and constitutional.
Yeah.
And
so while one is in that pursuit, should we perform any devotional service that we are asked to engage in and pray to Krishna that he reveal our, you know, service, or I mean, what should be the mode?
Be more precise with your question because it's kind of very broad. So are you saying if somebody says, you know, jump off the rooftop, should you do it? I mean, if it's not really my nature, I don't even think it's safe, should I do it anyway? Because that's not what you're asking. But, you know, some person, this is an issue. Should I, if I'm given a service that really doesn't match my nature, should I do it anyway because it's a service that's given to me? And just pray to Krishna that he'll give me the ability to do some service that's not my nature. Is that what you're asking? No.
Something along those lines. So there is a room. Is there a room for a dialogue between the spiritual
master
and the disciple?
Yes, I would hope so.
And it springs from a position where in this world, I mean, I can speak for myself, that the society doesn't really promote, encourage, it's just sort of a sheep mentality, everybody's doing this, so I also have to do this. So one doesn't even really know what one's nature is, and so one just goes along and...
You're saying material society?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we carry that well into the realms of devotional service as well.
Sure. Sure, we carry our conditioned tendencies. At the same time, let's just, you know, little detour here, but a number of you have described that, gee, the occupation that I have really doesn't suit my nature. I'm in the occupation I have because I got pumped up when I was a kid saying, you know, go get a good job, study hard, get some money. Because then when you got money, then you can be happy. And, you know, I was going, yeah, get some money, then I'll be happy. Study hard. Get that degree. Man, I really don't like this stuff. Now here I am, you know, in Krishna consciousness, and I got my job. And, you know, I have certain facilities that I can use in Krishna service because I have some money, but I really don't like this. It doesn't suit my nature. And there are some prior decisions you can't just bail on because it doesn't, you know, you don't feel that it suits your nature. there are other duties that one has to perform, and as I've discussed with several persons here, there are certain facilities that does come, or facilities that do come. With the income level that you now have, and you know, you can practice your Krishna consciousness and render varieties of service in ways that you might not be able to do if that facility wasn't there. And besides, for some persons here, at the stage of life that you're in, to have a career shift, that's a whole other thing. You know, that happens when you're younger. To redo it. I've seen some people try to do it, and it's really tough. Really tough. I mean, we watched Radha Gopal kind of do that, where, you know, he wanted to not completely change careers, but change emphasis in career, and he had to just drop off the map for a while, like a good while. We didn't see him. And I'm sure that was difficult for him. But you know, when you do it right, you got to really do it, and he really did it. And so we hardly saw him. That's it. That's a stiff price to pay. Without a super certainty of what's on the other end, either. So. You know, we bear the consequences of our previous choices in so many ways. And to do something impulsive or rashly abrupt doesn't necessarily indicate wisdom, and it doesn't necessarily bear good fruits. We do have to bear the consequences of previous choices we made. And if we want to redirect those choices, best to move in stages rather than, you know, in quantum impulsive jumps. That's just in the career department, and there's whatever else department. You know, where I'm living and who I'm married to, and, you know, so many other things that are the consequences of choices, and there's some things that are not the consequences of choices. Like who our parents are, and you know, what nation we're from, and stuff. But that's also the fruits of previous choices. You bear the consequences of those. So just take what you have and make the best use of it. And if you can incrementally move in the direction of something that more suits your nature, fine. And then you bear the consequences of what it means to do that, and the consequences of when you're on the other side of doing that. What's most important is that you're in the right consciousness when you're doing whatever you're doing. And when you're in the right consciousness, then even situations that you find don't so much suit your nature, at least you can be feeling some satisfaction that Krishna is pleased by the effort that you're making to try to please him. And that's really the essence of our Krishna consciousness, isn't it? Not fulfilling our psychophysical nature as much as that. Now, whatever our psychophysical nature is, we need some kind of, if you've made choices that place you in a situation that just doesn't feel right, something that matches your psychophysical nature needs to be taken up. Either an avocation or, you know, a particular dedication to serving Krishna in some way that matches your psychophysical nature. Anything else? Anything from the ladies' side? Yes?
Perhaps this may be off the topic a little. There's something I've been thinking about recently is, making offenses. I've been, when chanting, or after chanting, or before chanting, or during the day, feel this feelings of fear come in my mind, or about making offenses. Is that maybe because I've seen person who have fallen that bit, when their devotional life has been severely hurt because of making offenses, is having fear like that good or not?
Depends on the degree of it. Prabhupada indicated that one of the diseases of his Western disciples is that they don't have sufficient fear of Maya, or one can also think in that way, it's fear of offenses, but if it's fear of offenses, so that I'm getting this pervasive, spooky feeling, and I start to freeze and become catatonic, and I can't act because I have this fear that I might make some offense, then, you know, that's a little excessive. But to be aware of the risk of offenses, you know, so, and therefore take the important thing is, therefore take the proper precaution, not just live in fear. I could sit in my house and be afraid, you know, somebody might come in the house. Did you lock the door?
As a follow-up question, we've heard many times that mental offenses are not counted in Hindu Kali, but even so, they lead to offenses of speech and the body very quickly. So, if we do have these mental offenses, we're advised to seek forgiveness either from the holy name, Krishna, devotees. And if it's, sometimes I notice, at least in myself, there's so many offenses, Should it always be explicit? Can it be implicit? It can be internal sometimes if it's
yes.
not too
yes.
severe.
Yes. This concern that you're expressing seems to be fallen in the side of excessive. Excessively dwelling on this subject is go forward. And if some offensive thoughts enter, then you address them in a responsible way and move on. Don't dwell. Do volumes of offenseless service instead of getting consumed and meditating on, oh, I made some offenses. That will eradicate whatever reaction may be there. Anyone else? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.